am honored and humbled to have this grant. A lot of the things that I've written, I talk about, like how to have groups of people open up to each other in much wiser and wider ways than they usually do, and how to plug that into how our communities come together and how we make public policy which shapes all our lives. But I hadn't focused on that, and it was really interesting to have Gary highlight that dimension of my work. I looked a little closer at that, and the more I looked, the more I saw. One of my definitions for co-intelligence is the way we sense into what's real, what is really there. Because if we don't really notice what's there, we can't think well and feel well about it. And that there's a way in which the core of empathy is sensing into what's there in the other person. And I put up a bunch of different interesting definitions I ran across of empathy when I was preparing for this. And the dictionary says, basically, you step into somebody else's shoes, that's empathy. And NBC says, if you listen with a desire to really understand what somebody's experience is, that's empathy. And the other guy says, if you're willing to change your life in a way that will cause you to experience what somebody else is experiencing, that's empathy. These are all very true. And I'm going to be adding several other layers of empathy. And I just learned another upstairs several hours ago, I learned another dimension of empathy, where if you are entering into the being of an object, a tree or a rock or a chair, and really being with that in a very open way, that is also empathy with the world around you. I have a granddaughter, she's 2 years old. I just visited her. And we were playing on the floor. I built a little thing with blocks, and she'd knock it down. She said, I did that. I go, you did that. I built another thing and knock it down. I did that. You did that. And we went on for like 10 to 15 minutes like that. And I just build faster and faster, wilder things, and she'd knock them down. And that's a form of empathy. But Iris, my granddaughter, represents another form of empathy for me. She's going to be 88 years old in the year 2100. There's lots of people that get to be 88 years old now. I try to imagine what her experience is going to be like in the next 86 years. Wow. You know, it's like, what? She's going to be living through stuff I can't even imagine. And this is the voice of the seventh generation, as the indigenous people speak of sometimes, American Indians. Generation somewhere around 20 years, the seventh generation 140 years from now. That's like 2150. Who talks about 2150? The indigenous people say we should take that into account. What does it mean to be empathic with the seventh generation? How do we, particularly with the last definition there, how do we let our lives be shaped by understanding this perhaps most oppressed population ever? On my blog post, a generational privilege. Practically everybody on earth are a privileged generation compared to what may well be the generations of the future that far out. So I want to introduce into the inquiry about empathy this level of empathy. And that includes empathy with all the living systems, the living beings around us, with other people, all of this. It subsumes and goes beyond the empathy that we want to give to each other. And that involved in it, particularly mammals, particularly people, the sense of resonance with each other, and our experience watching somebody suffering, watching somebody's joy, watching somebody yawn. Suddenly everybody's yawning. You know, it's like we're built to have this resonance, and that's to get us to understand each other, be able to work together, help each other, bond us into communities. And in the early days, and still nowadays, it's like we are empathic with us, with our group, our tribe, our village, our family, and there's them over there. And empathy is designed to monitor the borders of the tribe so we know where to focus our attention. And we're running out of thems. We can't afford thems anymore. We're too connected. We're too powerful. We can have profound impacts on each other. I mean, the Trade Center was barely the beginning of what we can do with each other. What we've been doing in the Middle East, the whole thing, it's just like we can't afford to keep doing that. So part of the extent of expanded empathy, what I decided to call big empathy, is to expand into the future, expand into all the others that you can think of, you know. Okay, we can't stand George Bush or something like that, or we can't stand Barack Obama, depending on where your politics are. That's the other. As soon as you start othering somebody, there's a challenge. It's an indication. How can I expand into that? So that is part of what the expanded empathy is, like bridging over into time, through distance, through the invisibility that systems make. I just recently read about most of the chocolate in the world is made by enslaved kids in Africa. And it's like, why should we have to deal with slavery in order to eat a piece of chocolate? You know, things are just designed wrong in some very fundamental way. And there's lots of things like that. You just want to drive your car down to the next town, and you know as you're driving it that you're contributing to climate change. Like, something's fundamentally wrong about the design of things. So part of our challenge is to feel through the systems that make it hard to see the effects of our actions, and to be able to empathize with the people who are the recipients and the natural systems that are recipients of our actions. And that's a giant self-educational and mutual educational task. Robert Theobald, an economist who died in 1999, he said the main thing that's wrong with our societies, our social systems, is they make it so difficult to care effectively. Very interesting insight. I would add to that a PS, that they make it so easy to hurt and damage people and things without even knowing you're doing it. So for me, a lot of my focus has been on how to make systems, particularly political and governmental systems and economic systems, how do we design those systems so that they don't create damage, they create wise, compassionate, and positive effects. And that doesn't get anybody off the hook of trying to expand their own empathy, but we know how hard it is for each of us individually to expand in all those ways, to become enlightened beings. You know, it's like, this is a big challenge, takes a lot of work, a lot of time. In the meantime, the crises are running ahead. So is there some way we can buy time and create less damage by making it so that even when people are pursuing their self-interested actions, it ends up coming out good? It's like Aikido movement in the larger system. And how can we do this? Partly by helping groups of people be compassionate and empathetic and wise together in ways that actually shape what we are collectively doing, our public policies, our decisions to go to war, and all that sort of stuff. So these three branches that I have in my big empathy tree, one of which is expanding empathy, so who and what we are hitting with our empathy, our circle of concern, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the middle one is empathic practice. And things like nonviolent communication and a number of other practices that help us practice empathy, to help us take our basic fundamental empathic capacities and exercise them and make it into a spiritual practice that we do in our lives. And the third one is the embedded systemic empathy, which is like, how do we make economies and political systems that actually generate wisdom and goodness for everybody involved? So that's diving into a lot of this very intensively, and now I'm going to switch gears a bit and start talking about some of the things that actually do that. Just to introduce you right at the beginning to a really interesting innovation from 1991. This is the Time Magazine of Canada, McLean's magazine. This is a time when the Quebec people want to leave Canada, and the Indigenous people are, you know, what about us? A major, major time of disruption. They had their survey firm, their polling firm, pick 12 people who represented the diversity of Canada. These people were picked for their differences. And they gave them 2.5 days, a weekend, on a retreat center, to come up with a shared vision for what should happen in Canada. And they hired Roger Fisher, who is from Harvard, who is a co-author of a very famous book in circles I'm going called Getting to Yes, How to Negotiate from the Same Side of the Table Instead of Opposite Sides of the Table, to come up and be some of these people. And lots of things like that have been done before. Never has there been something with the publicity that was given to this. So in this magazine, there's all these people that have picked for this. 40 pages of coverage. 40 pages of coverage on anything we don't see. You know, they describe their project, And then they give bios of each of these people. So as you're reading the bios, you go, that guy's an asshole. This is really where it's at. You know, these people, I like this guy. And so you are being led into a vicarious experience by these little bios. I've never seen anything like that before. And they give a summary of the thing here. And then,
when was it?
1991, July 1991. And all this, incidentally, is on my co-intelligence.org website. Nowhere else on the web will you find any reference to this. I only know about this magazine because in the late 90s, some woman I was talking to about my work said, oh, I have in my throwaway magazines, I think I have something he's interested in. And, you know, dug this up for me going, well, it's not anything. You know, and I ordered the last 9 copies from their archive, and I got lost in the mail. I got 2 copies of this. That's all I know. Except all of it is up on the web. Interviews with people involved that I got somebody to do it up on the web. The Canadian Broadcasting hour-long documentary of it that they did simultaneously is up on the web. So now you have the blow-by-blow account. And you have these people sitting, you know, arms crossed, looking at each other, you know. And they go through it all. And then at the end, there's just page after page of what happened to it. And it almost fell apart. Sunday dinner, it was totally coming apart. And in the end, it wasn't facilitators that made it work, the negotiators. It was a couple of women. But I won't go into details. This was written up in detail in the Tao of Democracy. You can get a copy for them. So here they are, all these enemies hugging each other at the end. Then here's their thing that they came up with, and they all signed, you know. At the Declaration of Independence, there's John Hancock's at the bottom of it. And then they go, you know, here's they just talk to the facilitators, how they did it, and, you know, and the backgrounds, all the issues they were discussing, et cetera. Unbelievable. There were months of intense dialogue in Canada after that came out. I had somebody interview people who were involved in the Queens and people who were, Roger Fisher, who died shortly after he was interviewed. And they described in detail, you can listen and read all this stuff on my website. The possibility of doing this vicariously, you know, in the sense that you are taking this little microcosm of the whole country. You are giving them privileged access to each other in a context where they're actually being able to hear each other and interact in ultimately creative ways. And everybody in the country is watching that. And this is the sort of leapfrog, leverage, whatever you want to call it. We know how to do this in small groups. My colleague Rosa Zubizarreta, without whom Tao of Democracy and the other books would not have ever been written, is here. And she's going to do a little exercise of doing the kind of empathic reflection that happens in some of the most powerful processes we know for small group interactions. When you ask the question, ask it with whatever passion you have about it. Or if you're making a statement or whatever, and watch the kind of reflection that she does. And she'll write it up here. And I'm just going to collect a bunch of them and then I'll respond to them all together. Just to give you a little taste, the work that she does is with a process called dynamic facilitation, which is the most powerful conflict digesting process I know. You're not trying to resolve a conflict. And it doesn't, in fact, this process does not work if you do not have conflict energy in it. If everybody's being nice to each other, forget it, it's not going to work. You know. So it's taking the energy of the conflict and the differences of perspectives. And by really listening well to each person, the person kind of goes, huh, nobody ever listened to me before. You know, now I don't have to push my agenda because, you know, somebody listened, it's written up on the chart pad, you know, everything's cool. And so one by one, you're doing this to all these people, and 2 things are happening simultaneously. One, they're kind of opening up and relaxing and being able to hear each other. And their contribution to the mess, you know, their perspective and their, you know, well, what would you do about that, you know, facilitator asks, and they go a little deeper and give us possible solutions. You're getting the whole, all the different possible solutions, all the different ways of looking at the problem are being put up there. And as the process unfolds, there comes a kind of time where everybody's kind of open and the mess, we call it, the mess is up there in front of them, and this impulse arises collectively to try to make some sense of that mess. And people, well, what if we did this? You know, before that, they weren't talking together. It was just to the facilitator. But now, the facilitator kind of moves a bit into the background, and they're going, well, let's try that. So, well, no, let's try that. And, well, that means we should actually look at it like this, instead of a co-creative energy. somebody speaks up in the middle of it and goes, no, no, that's really stupid. So he'll say it right in front of them. What's your concern? Give it to me. Okay, what do you think should be done? And the conversation starts rolling again. It's very interesting, these little kind of interventions that at the bottom of them are about hearing each other. You know, are about empathy. Empathy is very powerful. It's like nonviolent communication and dynamic facilitation are two of the most powerful ways of using empathy. So we know how to create group magic with wildly different people in the room and to sort of lift them up out of their ordinary ways of being to a higher level of openness to their world and to all the factors that are involved, which they don't usually have, and to have them produce things that are useful for the larger society. Here's a We the People voice, sort of for the first time. We don't have a We the People voice. We have partisan voices. We have the Tea Party saying we're the people. We have Occupy saying we're the people. It's like, no, you're not. You know, the We the People is all of us in our diversity somehow coming together and saying, this is what's important to us. And we now know how to do that to a remarkable degree. There's still lots of edges to it. It's not all super simple. I like to compare it to Kitty Hawk, you know, and the Wright brothers threw their plane down the beach. People said, it can't fly. Well, we can. We can get the plane down the beach, you know, 80 feet down, 80 yards down the beach, we can get the plane, you know, with nobody holding it up, no balloons. But we need lots more than that. We need, you know, international jet travel kind of stuff with us. So there's lots of room for development, and the Powering Public Wisdom talks in an appendix about kinds of research we could do to get further with this. But what we know now is so much more powerful than what we've got. We don't have to wait that long. While I was researching Empowering Public Wisdom, I stumbled on the way Athens was organized in its heyday, way back when. The principle that governed Athens, random selection. We all know about the assembly. You know, everybody comes to vote on the, you know, proposals. Like, where did those proposals come from? They came from a group of 400 to 500 randomly selected citizens who served for a year in this thing called the Boule, and they would work up the proposals to bring to the assembly. 90% of the government jobs were staffed by random selection. The guys in charge of fixing the holes in the street, you know, randomly selected. You know, it's like, how can you run up? When you look at that, I go, how can you do that? And their performance was reviewed by a jury of their peers, randomly selected at the end of their job. And we're not told this. And there's reasons we're not told this. Aristotle said of the people of Athens that they believe that elections favor elites and random selection favors the people. And they considered this is what democracy was because all Athenian citizens in their lifetimes served at least once, if not two or three times, in an actual government job. They were the people. Of course, the citizens were all, you know, male, free, you know, blah, blah, blah. They didn't have slaves and people from other countries and women, you know, they weren't part of it. But that doesn't mean we couldn't do that. I mean, women are smarter than men anyway, right? So, you know, having random selection, there's people proposing, including me in the Empowering Public Wisdom, a randomly selected legislature, a people's legislature, to either add to or replace the House of Representatives. And in England, some people talk about the House of Commons should be done that way. It's starting to bubble up, this idea. We had to respect the people. Oh, my God, you know. It's just to take people off the street and make this big committee of them. Or, like, all the people that are there at the football game, you're going to make them in charge of making public policy or something. It turns out there are ways to handle that freak out about the quality of people and what they would do. But most important in random selection is that it creates this clean break. There's no human intervention in a random selection. So if your political system and government are filled with manipulation, with rich people controlling everything, with misinformation everywhere, it's like serious, total dysfunctional system. If you can inject random selection into that so that all that shit can't impact it, and then after the random selection create ideal forms of citizenship and decision making, you are in a totally different ballgame. And that's the idea of being able to generate public wisdom and then empower it. That's what the Empowered Public Wisdom is about. the DAO democracy covers a whole pile of general things. It's less programmatic, and it doesn't stress random selection so much. But I wish everyone who was an activist and every group that was an activist group would invest at least 20% of their time and energy and resources in pushing some form of random selection, because the way the system we have now, it's like garbage in, garbage out. Except you put really good things in, garbage comes out. And there's another general principle for us, usually diversity and disturbance, dissonance, disagreement are a problem. And part of what my work is trying to point out is they're actually a resource if we know how to use them creatively. All great evolutionary leaps come from massive disturbances. We wouldn't be here if there hadn't been massive explosions of stars and supernovas, because that's how every level of any complexity can only be created, by the explosion of a star, the most violent force in the universe. And we are the result of stars that lived and died before our sun was born. So that's just an example. Here is another interesting representation of all that. I just finished reading this book. You're not as crazy as I thought, but you're still wrong. I'm part of a group called the National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation, which is having its biannual meeting coming up, conference that Rosa and I will be going to. And these are two guys. One is a conservative and one's a liberal. He's a Mormon conservative guy, a Mormon, very religious-oriented Mormon, all that. But they very much want to have conversations. And they met each other and decided that they would have a conversation about all the big issues that divide liberals and conservatives. And it took 2 years. And this is a record of their conversations. Absolutely fascinating reading. There's not a cent of compromise anywhere in here. There's not a cent of backing off. There's like, this is the way I am, and oh, I hear the way you are, and that's interesting. There's certain things I really disagree with you on, but I begin to see why you see it that way, and there's some really useful ways to look at that, to look through your eyes at it. It's a very different kind of conversation than anything we see around here, and this is a living proof of what's possible. Another interesting tool in the midst of all this is this group called National Issues Forum, and they're probably the largest citizen deliberative activity in the country. They don't come up with a coherent, we the people kind of voice, which a lot of the other things that I deal with do. But they have developed a thing called framing an issue for deliberation. When you frame an issue for debate, you figure out, how can I talk about it to get people to think the way I want them to think? So like, a conservative will say, taxes are a burden. And a liberal will say, taxes are the dues you pay to live in civilization. Both kind of true, and depending on where you're at a particular time, you get swayed. So there's a whole art in the world of political PR of framing your issue for debate so that people will lean in your direction. Framing an issue for deliberation is totally different. Framing an issue for deliberation is saying, here are 3 to 5 ways to consider this issue, whatever issues you're talking about. You never pick 2 ways, that creates a polarized kind of energy. And you never pick more than 5 because, you know, people can't think of more than 5, can't hold it in their heads. So 3 to 5 ways, and it should sort of cover the ground for the mainstream dialogue on this issue. And then you say, here are the arguments for this, each one of these. Here's the evidence that people have. Here's the sort of people involved in this. All written for when you read it, you go, oh, I see how those people think. It's not like, oh, God, not this again. So it's written consciously to be from the viewpoint of somebody who really believes it and makes a good case for it. You go, oh, yeah. So at the beginning of a deliberation, people will often be given this information as briefing materials. So they're kind of, oh. So already shaken a bit out of however they came in the room. And there's various ways to go on from there. Dynamic facilitation doesn't use this kind of thing. Dynamic facilitation, in its political application, which mostly is a thing called the Community Wisdom Council, it picks a randomly selected group of people, like in a community, right around here. You pick a randomly selected bunch of people around here, a dozen of them, and you go, so how's it going here? Well, what would you like to talk about? And then they start doing dynamic facilitation with them. And they end up, after a day and a half, coming up with some statement to bring to the community. And usually the people who are involved in this are blown out of their minds. This is so amazing. I've never had any kind of citizenship like this before. We're so different, and we can talk together, blah, blah, blah. So there's a public meeting, and they're doing all this in front of the public meeting. And then they get out into the group, and the group people in the public meeting start talking together, you know, discussing what they've heard from the Wisdom Council. And the idea is to infect the community with this different kind of conversation, which the guy who created it, Jim Rough, calls choice creating. So we're all in this together, trying to think together about it, and setting up facilitation sort of creates that kind of conversation. So you want to get that out into the world so lots of people are thinking that, and the Wisdom Council is a great way to do that. So I'm going to do one more. This is a more cultural one. An actress and drama teacher, her name is Anna DeVere Smith. She was on West Wing, Nurse Judy or whatever her name is. In her earlier iteration, she created these two one-woman shows about riots. One was about the Rodney King riots in L.A., called Twilight Los Angeles, and the other was about the Blacks and Jews riot in Crown Heights, and she called that one Fires in the Mirror. And she went around and interviewed a bunch of people, interview the cop, interview someone who was hiding away, interview some store owner, interview the person who threw the thing through the window. So she talks to about 24 people, and she then becomes those people in this one-woman show. She's a light-skinned black woman, and she can kind of be all these different roles believably. She's an excellent imitator of accents. And so she dresses up like a black Muslim, or she dresses up like a community organizer, and she talks with their lingo. And you watch these 5 or 6 minute vignettes, one after another, and they all have the same face in them. It's like, this is humanity talking to us. It would be different if you did a documentary of these people talking. You have this whole different sense of what a riot is when you finish. There's no easy way to describe what happened there. This is a gigantic ecosystem, upheaval, human event. And you get that. You get that at a deep empathic level. And you have been driven to empathize with so many different people by the time you're finished, whose stories do not fit together. And that's the point. So there's a kind of collective empathy, you with a collective of this event. And anybody who is into drama, so I have some stuff on my website about her work under the headline of Multiple Viewpoint Drama. But you can search on YouTube for Fires in the Mirror. They have each of her vignettes in separate little YouTube things. It's practically impossible to get the Twilight Los Angeles thing now. So I highly recommend that, and that is a model for cultural innovations that would transform people's tendency to stick to one viewpoint and sort of unstitch you from a single viewpoint. And the next one is the economic one, which I talked about in my 12th grade class here. I referred earlier to the fact that our economy causes you to take toxic, damaging actions that you don't want to do. And if you want to get away from them, you have to pay more. You want to get your organic food and your cotton that was made organically by the right kinds of people, like cotton is one of the toxic industries there is. You have to pay more. Who can pay more? So the economy is designed all backwards. So what would happen if you could take the environmental and social damage that was involved in a product's production and distribution and use and waste and whatever, if you take that and how much it costs the society to handle that? Because the company makes it, they don't have to worry about the cost. They make the product and they sell it, and economists talk about that's an externalized cost onto the taxpayers and future generations and stuff. It's not our business, that's somebody else's business. I just make the product and get it out to people, they want it, I'm doing a good job. And it's cheap. If you could take those costs and somehow embed them in the price of the product, all the toxic bad products would be way more expensive than the good products. And one of the simplest examples of that is a carbon tax. If you tax carbon and all the emissions that come out of carbon and have that embedded in all the things that are involved in emitting that carbon, they become more expensive. And suddenly, it's just not driving your car so much, you know. And you're not buying a bunch of things that are very productive of carbon emissions. And that has a really interesting effect, because then the self-interested search for a bargain heals the world instead of destroying it. Isn't that interesting? Somebody has bothered to do all the work of embedding those costs into the products. You don't have to think, is this a socially responsible product? You can. Of course, it'll all look like organic. You know, it's like they established the organic thing at a national level, official thing, and now all the powers of beer are trying to mess with the organic standard. So it's always good for us who know more to try and ride the occasion. But having an organic standard nationally makes more people eat organic and damage the world less. So that's an example of a systemic intervention that has an empathic impact on the society without necessarily having the individuals involved in it being empathic. It will take empathic individuals to design such a system, but it makes it so that everybody else behaves much more sensibly. If you have questions about anything I've said, or you really feel strongly about something that you would have liked to comment on, feel free to ask or say it now. And I'm going to turn this section over to Rosa to do a little reflection back to you as you say your thing. So you are invited to share whatever passion is authentic for you about whatever it is you want to say or ask. And if nobody says or asks anything, I'll launch again
so you get the chance. Rosa. Any questions or comments or reflections?
I would like to just pose the question that I'd be interested to hear from Tom what he thinks about the civil society conversations that are happening.
Civil society.
By that, well, people are using this term like in Europe and all over. They're speaking about civil society.
And your sense of what they mean by civil society conversation.
Not what they mean. I'm wondering what Tom has to say.
Sure.
Yeah, I would like to also hear more of what they're saying, too, so it gives me a little more field to comment on. I can take those two words, but,
Well, I just wondered if you had contact with it already in the world.
Okay.
I think the question comes out of the perspective that civil society stands between the unholy lines between big business and big government, just to orient that question.
So there's big business, big government, and then this is like a third sphere.
Yeah, it's a third sphere.
And civil society. And just kind of what does Tom think about all this, just kind of a very general question.
Wonder if you're talking about the sort of randomization of governmental services and use. Went as far as road work, etc. So there is sort of in some cultures still the notion of when one launches into one's life, coming out of high school, there's a year of service. People are generally lukewarm, too enthusiastic. There isn't so much resistance to that. But when it comes to jury duty and they're in their 40s and they have the kids and the gun, there's a lot of resistance to being drawn. And I guess every person who I've ever talked to about being on jury duty has said that they tried to get out of it, which is surprising to me. I think it's exciting. So I wonder, with this whole question of randomization, to what extent, and particularly in an age where everybody is just so, I'm going to go into government, I'm going to do this really funny thing, I'm just going to be there for a year, it's going to be hilarious. what is the sort of, maybe a little bit just in that direction.
So how would random selection go over with people given their resistance to jury duty? Something along those lines.
Yeah, just a general attitude of, in surprising instances where I thought people would take something seriously, and they just become so disconnected from it that it just all becomes a big joke.
Cool. Let me take someone who hasn't yet, and then we'll come back to you again.
Was really kind of up for the city, and they were talking about what is making it. And you heard about needing to stay attuned with the younger people that she teaches and how really her perspective and the things that are important to her, there is such a difference. And I feel like I sort of live isolated up, and sort of pick and choose what information comes to me. But that fascinated me. I think, is it really true that younger generations' perspective is shifting a lot faster with the internet? And how intergenerationally do you keep in touch with each other? I don't know if the younger generation is interested in general and that general in staying in touch with the older generation, but is it true and how do you embrace that?
So part of the reason for what we're doing this is that it gives Tom an opportunity to kind of hear what all the various perspectives are, and then in his response, he might respond in a way that addresses like several of the questions and like that. So what I wrote is this question about gaps between generations, is it true, and how to bridge it, and how to stay in touch.
It's funny, we had random selection during the Vietnam War, and a lot of people didn't want to go.
Oh, yeah.
There's a problem with that. I wanted to ask, you mentioned McLean's. Have you ever tried to get Tom interested in doing something in this country? That's a magazine that could do it, and they publish stuff, whole issues.
Could we do that here? Huh?
Yeah, that's my question.
In the way you described this evening and in some of your work, various methodologies, techniques, approaches, system design and redesign approaches, but it seems to me that that's an outer dimension. And it seems to me that these methods don't work unless people are willing to work on themselves. Now, they can stimulate such a process. So I'm wondering about how you see this question of inner development in relationship to external social change.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll put it differently. In my experience working as an advisor and facilitator, in every project, I've had to work on something in myself in order to actually help my clients.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And if I wasn't willing to do some of that work, I couldn't help them.
Cool. So what I wrote down, Chris, is can just working on the outer dimension work without people working on themselves? What is the relationship between inner development and social change? And then this experience of inner change on the part of the facilitator being really important for being able to work with.
Yeah, I think the second way, inner development and social change covers it pretty much.
So yeah, cool.
Take a couple more.
Great questions here.
Yeah.
When you were talking about systemizing empathy and having small groups of people be the ones who write the plan for that in terms of like a carbon tax, and then other people, the rest of the citizens, sort of go along unaware that they're causing less harm. And, I don't know, maybe that's like a more efficient way to do it, but does that actually awaken every single human being to an experience of empathy, or are some people simply automatically plodding along the way that they were, whereas small groups are waking up? So that picture was a question.
Yeah, so what I put was, if we do this thing with systematizing empathy, by having small groups of people create systems that allow others to be unaware, would that awaken everyone, or would that just kind of like allow people to continue to be unconscious? I mean, you didn't say that last part, but just a bit. Okay, cool, thank you.
And my question definitely piggybacks on both of these. I also have a question about allowing the unconsciousness to, and I don't mean like, oh, everybody should become conscious like I'm conscious. I mean, does society need to continue to evolve? And I guess the picture that came up for me is Bill O'Reilly is right now proposing a mercenary force, 25,000 troops that would go around the world, and they would be the peacekeeping force, or they would, you know, they'd be hired hands. So we wouldn't have to send our good soldiers to war. And I guess what it makes me think of right now is just a couple of generations ago, there was like the last good war, the Great War, World War II, and the first one. Just that at one point there were things, there were like ideals, and war is not an ideal, but there were ideals that people were like, oh, America, or, and now it's kind of like, oh yeah, like everything is, and like, it's just, it's an example to me of like, even in war, no one's got their heart kind of in anything. And I think it's because it's good that they don't have their heart in it. But yeah, it's just like, oh, well, we'll let people like continue to watch TV and like, you know, just go their way. And there's like no ideals that kind of fire us anymore. And I don't think we need groupthink or anything like that, but I just think we need some transformative ideals coming in. Socialist.
Yeah, so I'm hearing this more as a comment than a question.
Well, it's a question specifically about, I mean, it's what Nadia said about letting people kind of, you know, like, oh, and, you know, we could get the right systems and everybody could continue to be self-interested.
Okay. So if you created these systems, would those allow unconsciousness to remain? And is that a good thing? And then you asked something about does society need to continue to evolve. I wasn't sure what clear where you were going to have, but you mentioned the mercenary force. And this is a statement of, like, there's no ideals these days, and we need transformative ideals. Your concern is that if you have a system here that would help people do the right thing without having to think about it, that would get in the way of people continuing to evolve?
No, it's just a little bit what Gary said at the very beginning, like having an ideal of, like, oh, social life could be actually fueled by very different. You know, there's a basic picture that human beings are, their basic nature is self-interest. And I don't know if that's particularly true.
Mm-hmm.
I don't particularly believe it's true, and I think actually we could kind of fall into a hole in that, with that one.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take one more.
One more, and then you'll respond to all of this. Cool.
Along these lines, in your comments that you made about setting prices that were in accordance with production, consumption, and then waste or recycling, so that it cannot contain that. Also coming from this line of questions that just preceded what I'm saying, it seems to me like if there was a culture or even a law where that kind of deliberation was required to come to prices, you would want as many people in the population as possible to actually think about production, consumption, and waste processes. Because in a certain sense, it's like finding yourself at home in life. You know, realizing what scarcity there are in certain areas of nature, where wealth is. In a certain sense, stopping to be such a zombie, in your daily economic self, like you were saying, we go around and, we constantly, of course, consuming, purchasing products, but they're kind of like veils in front of our eyes, including the price tags. But then if you think about all the social conditions and everything behind it, though I can be very inspired about the idea of coming to a true price, I would feel somehow a little bit depressed to stop at a true price if the whole population wasn't, like you were saying, involved on some kind of rhythmic basis in learning or experiencing how you come to a true price. Because that, for me, equals actually social consciousness and ecological consciousness, and therefore also empathy. Because when I think about fair trade, for instance, I've seen it. You go in the store and there's these products on the shelf and they cost more than other products. And people are not suffering so much when they pay more for those products. They're doing it because they care and they can see through, the veil was lifted a little bit, and they know this is actually a just price. Not a just price yet, but towards a just price.
So I added that last bit as a statement. People pay more because they care. And also this other thing, your point that you would want as many people as possible to think about those externalized costs and where they come from, so that there would be like a general greater awareness.
And I heard one additional part of that. It sounded like for you, the conversation about the true cost was as or even more important than the actual arriving at the true cost.
Right.
And the sense of consciousness raising that comes from having that conversation counters the fact that people don't have to think about it because the price is just there.
Yeah.
Something like that. The last several questions had a very definite theme to them. I'm going to address them first. First of all, when this was done,
the Queen's Magazine,
what happened was people didn't sit back. People started talking amongst themselves. This triggered conversation. To the extent, well, most of these processes that are like that, or citizen jury, consensus conference, all these things that I promote, are usually not done in such a public way. So it's almost like a committee off on the side. And that minimizes the amount of consciousness raising and conversational engagement that happens. But I want to re-stress the fact on Empowering Public Wisdom and Tao Democracy, you don't read a lot about spirituality in that. If you read my evolutionary activism book, you'll get tons of spirituality in it. But the other two, it's because we have this, for very good reasons, this separation of church and state thing, and people are sufficiently different in their spiritual sensibilities that if you even use the word spiritual, it's okay, you're trying to do something religious here and needs to be separated out. So I just avoid that. But what happens in these groups is, in fact, spiritual. The kinds of openings that you have to do to participate in these groups with the help of the facilitator, who's trying to make sure everybody's heard and everybody's hearing everybody, something happens in these. They are personally transformative perspectives. These people, and there's thousands of them now who've been through these kinds of processes, are wasted because the process is done and they go back in their lives. They are an organizing force, potentially, for creating this kind of change. Nobody's ever used them that way before. But I've talked to bunches of them, and you see interviews with them. It's like they've had a peak experience during this process. And they go back out in their lives, and they're sucked into the rest of the world, just like you go to your meditation retreat or whatever, and you go back in your life, and it's just not the same anymore. So the same thing happens to them. It feels like how you design the process impacts what kind of broader transformational impact it has. If you have the people who participated talking in a passionate and public way about what they went through, there's a kind of direct transmission thing that happens, and also keeps their sense of it alive. So that's one of the reasons I pushed that kind of thing. It was a bunch of us who were trying to think of how to do a TV program, Wisdom Council, to feature this particular kind of powerful conversation that happens in dynamically facilitated Wisdom Councils. So I am totally for personal transformation, and that middle branch there about empathic practice is part of my sense of what needs to happen. Those of us who are already on that track need to practice and get better at it. We need to pull more people into practicing and getting better at it. But in the meantime, the world is getting trashed, people are being wiped out, people are being messed with seriously, and the future generations, including my granddaughter, I can't even imagine a possibility for this world where my granddaughter has surviving granddaughters. It's that bad for me, you know. I think we are headed for some really rough times, and we need to think about how we can slow this destructive machine, these destructive narratives. And so while I am totally in favor of the transformation of all of us individually, it feels almost like a privileged thing to say, I don't have to worry about the larger system. It's going to make everybody else forget. We need to all change. But how do you do that? How do you actually get 7 billion people? You know, I mean, it boggles the mind. If you have ideas of how to do that, or if that's where your passion is, definitely go for it, because that's part of the puzzle also. But where are the people who are actually changing the system? That's part of my thing. It's so rare. You talk about as a facilitator, you need to do transformation. Absolutely. But one facilitator can transform all these other people's lives and do all this other stuff. But the impact of one person doing that form of servant leadership is profound. And yes, you should be as enlightened and capable as you possibly can to do that work and take the feedback from the problems that show up and the problematic people and how you can feel your self-response, take that as lessons for your own transformational journey. But that transformational journey is, for me, and everybody has my own decisions, for me, that transformational journey, if we focus only on ourselves and those immediately around us, is back to the sort of old form of empathy, which doesn't meet the challenges that we're faced with. So another book I recommend to everybody called New World, New Mind. It is by a guy who's wrote a book called Psychology of Consciousness, Robert Ornstein, and Paul Ehrlich, who made The Population Explosion famous. Odd couple to be writing a book. And in that book, they talk about we live in an overwhelmingly human-created world. We live in a world of primarily human-created dangers. Most of the opportunities we have are human-created or potentially human-created. So our ability to see and feel and think and respond hasn't evolved very much in the last 10,000 years. We weren't living in this 10,000 years ago. Mary Jane fell down the well, headlines, you know, way in the back of an article on global warming. Our cognitive systems are not designed to encounter what we're facing. And we need to upshift in various ways. And our empathic, not all animals are empathic. Not all people are empathic. But overwhelmingly, it's mammals that have this empathic response. And humans particularly have this empathic response. And we need to accept that as an evolutionary given. Evolution has given us that gift, and we should develop it. But evolution, by giving us these problems, we made these problems. Not individually, but collectively, by the kinds of systems that we have, we've created climate change, we've created financial collapse, we've created all these things are our creations, and what that means is they are information for us telling us what we need to change. When you're going about your life and you run into some difficulty, that's an indication of something. Hey, take a look, you know, pay attention, put some change energy, some conscious change energy into that. That's what these problems are from an evolutionary perspective. They're pain in the side, you know. Figure out what's wrong with me. Do something different. From my perspective, the converging mega crises are a wake-up call for us to include and transcend the empathic capacities. We need to have better kinds of intelligence, more expansive, inclusive kinds of intelligence. We need to have better and more inclusive kinds of empathy. We need to have bigger, inclusive kinds of bodies, you know, to recognize that this body is not the only body, you know. We are an expression of the whole planet, the whole universe. We're not all that separate as we think we are. all these things need to get bigger in order for us to face these challenges wisely and become the other thing we're supposed to become individually and collectively. Evolution goes from simple parts and makes more complex things than doing that since the Big Bang. And we are separate parts on a planet that don't fit together. Our technologies, our economic systems, our individualness, our corporations, all these things are not fitting together. This is a planet that's in the process of deconstructing itself. And our challenge is to become this new multicellular organism where humanity and nature and individual and collective and all our technologies fit. And that's, you know, the dream of sustainability. And there's a way from an evolutionary perspective. Cool, what a neat challenge. There's a chapter in my book, Does Compassion and Self Need to Evolve? We need to get beyond ourselves in even bigger ways than putting our attention on other people. We need to put our attention on other people. I'm not saying not to do that, but the challenge is so much bigger than that. So that's my response to this last page. I think you could use these collective ways of presenting empathy, the power of empathy, to actually uplift lots of people. You're not going to get everybody. You never do, you know. But I don't think these two things are contradictory in any way. I'm just peeling this to you. Look at the systemic thing also. And the systems are putting nonviolent communication in grade schools. You know, it's like systemic changes can also be addressed to transforming the individual's capacity to be empathic. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just have to be changing that system structure. And the nature of human beings, overwhelming evidence is we can be practically anything, depending on the context in which we are. We are competitive, we are cooperative, we are selfish, we are altruistic. Overwhelmingly, the context determines how we're going to be together. So I don't think human beings are basically anything. Human beings are basically everything, and that's what makes us unique. And we have a chance to use that to transform ourselves and our societies. Gap in generations. I feel so technologically backward. I read a thing that somebody said generations, that was like 8 years ago or something, said generation is 8 years now. You know, the 8-year-olds are living in a technologically totally different world than the 16-year-olds. I don't know how to deal with that. I don't do videos. I go on Facebook because I'm forced to. You know, there's a way in which I'm not living in the same world as other people. Face-to-face citizens live with councils? Is that real? What's online? You know, it's like, what? I don't know. So I don't feel I have stretched in the right direction to do that. And I would invite the various young people we have here to speak to how this serves them or not. I don't know. Random selection. Oh, there's whole stories on that. The random selection of the Vietnam War was because it was fair. That's one of the things random selection does. It makes things fair. The fact that it's a war sucks. But one of the uses for random selection in society is to distribute scarce resources or undesirable circumstances. There are countries where you get into college by random selection, and it's ultimately fair but totally inadequate. But I was a draft resistor in the Vietnam War, and it's weird because my draft resistance was part of a movement that gave us a volunteer army. And the volunteer army is made up much more of people who want to be there. And the Vietnam War, people didn't want to be in it, and they became very active against the war. This was not all activism, it was purely productive. No, I haven't tried to get Time Magazine interested. I tried to get McLean's interested to do a 20-year thing in 2010. I wrote to a group in Canada that does dialogue and deliberation and said, look at what McLean's did. Can you try and get McLean's to do a thing in a 20-year anniversary in 2011? And they wrote back to me, what's so special about what McLean's did? And I was just caught in the time. I was in the process of helping my partner die over, you know, ovarian cancer over, you know, 5 months. And I didn't. If they didn't get it, I didn't have the wits to explain to them. I heard them back to it. But it's there to be done. Anybody can do that. You have everything I know about McLean's magazine is now on my website. So if anybody wants to pick up the ball and carry it to Time Magazine, if you have any contact say whatsoever, I encourage you to do that. Civil society, yeah. If I'm understanding that right, in this sense, that has become much more than Europe. It's UN talks in that way. It's like you have business and government, and you have the nonprofit or NGO world, And then there's civil society, which is like a fourth thing. This is an emerging. This is all the people in the streets with their umbrellas now in China, all these colored revolutions they're talking about. Although there's weird ways that the United States helps certain colored revolutions when they want to topple a particular dictator, which is too bad, but I've studied a lot of those nonviolent revolutions. So this kind of thing, as far as civil society. Anybody getting together in ways that aren't all being hyper-organized by these different forces. So yes, I think this is great, and I would love it if more civil society entities or groups like this wanted to do something like this. I was talking to Gary about the idea of the anthroposophic, is it, folks, who are often want to get involved in politics because of some important life-affirming, life-damaging kind of issue, but through the kind of partisan dynamics that we have. I was saying, notice the word party. You know, it's specifically about a part of the whole. But if you do it for the whole, you have holy. The alternative to party is holy. So to what extent would people who want to honor the whole more in their work maybe become servant leaders in communities and say, we're not going to take a side in this, but we will help you come together, talk together creatively, and have that be part of the identity of the interface that you folks have with the larger world around you. I don't know if that works or not. I'm not one of that group, but I think it could be a very interesting thing to talk about. So random selection. Yeah, people don't want to be randomly selected. Once you get into random selection, as beautiful it is, it is incredibly complicated. The issue of what is the pool from which we randomly select? There's no such thing as a perfect random selection. We use voter rolls, usually, in these things. So either people are kind of involved politically, and we have that database available to use. And I read a thing by a major polling firm, what they were having to go through. Things are so complicated. You can't just do phone numbers anymore. You have a cell phone by listing stuff. You know, you can't knock on doors. It's just the level of complexity our society has gotten in mode is very complex. And juries use voter rolls to select people for juries. And this is enforced. You've got to serve. And so then you just resist the enforcement. A jury is deciding a case. You are deciding a public policy for your community. That's what it's involving. The level of power you have as a citizen to participate in something like that is much greater. We're doing this Wisdom Council in North Carolina. They have like 400 randomly selected people. They're busy calling them all up. They've been doing this for days, and they got like 5 people so far. Because they don't know what this thing is. It's a group of citizens who are deciding to pull together another group of citizens and have them talk for a day and a half. And it's just like, who are you? What are you trying to sell me? Because they don't have any way to think about it. It's like if you're the only person who has a fax machine, it's totally useless to you. It kind of has to become part of the culture. Similarly, people have to kind of know what this means to do this. You know, if we were doing this in a concerted way, you'd have more and more people responding, saying, yes, I'd like to participate, if they had a clue what was happening.
Also, I did want to mention when it comes to the jury thing that there are studies that as much as people resist it going in, right, so many people afterwards report a positive experience and say that they would do it again.
No, and they become more civically engaged.
I haven't read the research, but it does seem like that.
Right. That's sort of it. Anybody have one of their questions they don't think has been well answered? It's getting on towards 9:30. You've all been very kind. You've been sitting here for a couple hours. Thank you.